Welcome everyone, I'm your host, Emerson Green. Inspired by Matthew Adelstein's post defending epiphenomenalism, I wanted to explain my opposition to the view. A few times he referenced a podcast episode slash blog post of mine from 2020, which I hadn't read since it was first posted, and I found a few things to disagree with in my own article, so I thought I'd respond to Matthew and try to offer an updated critique of epiphenomenalism in the process. While epiphenomenalism is probably less wrong than physicalism, the causal efficacy of our mental states is as evident as anything, so the view should still be rejected in favor of panpsychism or interactionism. So first, what is epiphenomenalism? Epiphenomenalism is the view that mental states have no effect on anything. The feeling of pain, counterintuitively, does not cause your aversion, mentally or physically. Beliefs don't cause behavior. None of our actions occur in virtue of our thoughts, feelings, or sensations. As it's usually construed, the view is a form of dualism. In fact, it's the kind of dualism advocated by David Chalmers in The Conscious Mind, and formerly by Frank Jackson, the originator of the knowledge argument. I have to mention this because some people seem to find it surprising that it's a form of dualism. But consider the fact that on epiphenomenalism, the mental and the physical are distinct in crucial respects. For instance, one possesses causal powers, while the other does not. Moreover, brain events and mental events happen at different times. There's not just causal priority, there's seemingly also temporal priority. First come the physical events, then come the mental events. Well, if these two kinds of events are happening at completely different times, and one causally impacts the world, while the other has no effects at all, then they are obviously not identical. Michael Humer pointed out in our conversation on dualism that some physicalists on the internet will make their case in a confused way. Brain states cause mental states, therefore, mental states are identical to brain states. But assuming that nothing can be the cause of itself, the argument entails the negation of their conclusion. Brain states cause mental states, therefore brain states are not identical to mental states. Epiphenomenalists, on the other hand, are not at risk of being inconsistent when they appeal to evidence that brain states cause mental states. So before offering a few reasons to think epiphenomenalism is false, I'm going to turn to a few key points in Matthew's post that I think are crucial for understanding the motivation for epiphenomenalism. He says, quote, "It's hard to make interactionism consistent with the conservation of energy." So part of the motivation for epiphenomenalism is a belief in the causal closure of the physical, meaning there are no outside non-physical things that exert a causal influence on the physical world, and relatedly, the conservation of energy, which some people believe is violated by rejecting physical causal closure. However, I'm not convinced that interactionism violates conservation of energy in the first place. Some physicalists make the mistake of conflating conservation of energy with causal closure, but while interactionism would violate the causal closure of the physical, it would not necessarily run afoul of conservation. As physicalist David Papineau explains, quote, "The conservation of energy in itself does not tell which basic forces operate in the physical universe. Are gravity and impact the only basic forces? What about electromagnetism, nuclear forces, and so on? Clearly, the conservation of energy as such leaves it open exactly which basic forces exist. It requires only that, whatever they are, they operate deterministically and conservatively." End quote. So as long as emergent mental forces, quote-unquote, operate in such a way as to pay back all the energy they borrow and vice versa, they've acted conservatively. As I said, I don't think it would violate conservation of energy, just like it wouldn't violate conservation if we postulated an additional fundamental physical force. But let's just grant that in order to truly preserve conservation, we have to accept the causal closure of the physical. And it's not like conservation is the only reason people adopt causal closure anyway, so let's just grant that the physical world is causally closed. Now we have to be epiphenomenalists, right? Well, no. We still don't need to reject mental causation. We can't be interactionists, but we can still be Russellian panpsychists and preserve both mental causation and the causal closure of the physical. On a dual aspect theory, the relationship between the physical and the experiential is not one of cause and effect. There's only one processual flux, but there are two irreducible, perfectly correlated aspects of nature. What it's like to be that process, and the observation of that process from the outside. Two sides of the same coin. Moving along, Matthew says, quote, "Nothing in neuroscience suggests violations of causal closure of the physical, as we'd expect, if epiphenomenalism were false." Would we expect to see that, though? Even granting that we would expect neuroscience to reveal some kind of empirical indication that epiphenomenalism is false, the modern tools of neuroscience are extremely blunt. For example, fMRI has a very low resolution. Every pixel on a brain scan corresponds to 5.5 million neurons. There's a limit to how much detail these scans are able to show. So we shouldn't appeal to neuroscience to settle disputes. It's just not in a position to settle, at least at this point in history. So he goes on to talk about the Libet experiments. Quote, "For many decisions that we believe to be under our conscious control, one can predict whether we'll take them before we come to a decision about them." End quote. It's true that neuroscientists can sometimes predict what choice you'll make before you yourself are consciously aware of which choice you'll make. So the argument goes something like this. There's something in the brain that neuroscientists have discovered that seems to precede conscious awareness, and this shows that consciousness doesn't play a role in producing action. This not only targets free will, but mental causation. So first, in most of these experiments, participants are asked to perform simple tasks or movements, like flexing a muscle or pressing a button. Can we really generalize from those kinds of decisions to all our decisions? In order to defend the idea that Libet-style experiments disprove the causal efficacy of conscious deliberation, we'd have to defend the premise that all the decisions we make are like the decisions studied in the experiments. But what exactly is the relevant similarity between deliberating for months whether you'll marry your partner and being told by a researcher to flex your wrist at a random moment of your choosing? I can think of quite a few relevant differences. Another problem with the generalization premise is the methodology of many Libet-style experiments. As Dr. Matthew Flummer explains,
"These kinds of experiments are based on averages, and that seems to pose a problem. You know, the way averages work, they probably fall in some kind of bell curve. So that means there's going to be people on either end of the bell curve that didn't have the readiness potential like we saw in the graph. So that's another reason to doubt."
Is epiphenomenalism self-defeating? If I say I love the taste of this coffee, we're naturally inclined to think that the taste, experience, caused my comment, verbal behavior. But an appeal to my experience in the explanation of my verbal behavior is off-limits to the epiphenomenalist, phenomena which are side effects of physical processes, themselves incapable of exerting any reciprocal influence over the material world, could not possibly produce such an effect, yet here we are discussing them. An epiphenomenalist must hold that mental states are causally inert, and therefore couldn't cause utterances about consciousness, including statements about the truth of epiphenomenalism. One, if conscious phenomena have no effects on anything, we would not be able to discuss conscious phenomena. Two, we can obviously discuss conscious phenomena. Three, therefore it is false that conscious phenomena have no effects on anything. So here's Matthew's response to this kind of argument. Quote, "Epiphenomenalists think that there are some brain states that correlate with consciousness. In fact, we generally think that those neural states that correlate with consciousness represent similar information to that represented by consciousness. For instance, your brain processes pain as a negative signal that it tries to avoid, just as you consciously experience pain as something negative that you want to avoid. As a result, it looks like consciousness is causing things. This is because consciousness represents the same information as is represented in the brain. And the information represented in the brain generates consciousness. So while it looks like pain causes you to pull your hand to move away, instead the purely physical brain state that represents pain causes one to pull away, and in combination with the psychophysical laws also causes the conscious states." Once we have this understanding in hand, a lot of objections to epiphenomenalism disappear quickly. Assuming this kind of picture is coherent, it can successfully explain the production of a very convincing illusion. It seems like my mental state is causing my behavior, because my mental state represents the thing that really is causing my behavior. Though I'm not sure what it means to say that my mental representations are similar to my brain states, especially on a dualistic view, Why is my mind representing brain activity as a green quale? Because it's similar? On a dualistic view, it's hard to see what the intrinsic similarity could be between an experience and the physical thing/event that caused it. So, granting that epiphenomenalism is a coherent possibility doesn't imply anything about its plausibility. But a coherent response does provide a basis for rejecting the first premise of the self-defeat argument outlined above. Epiphenomenalists can explain how verbal behavior could apparently be caused by sensations without really being caused by sensations. So, on epiphenomenalism, it seems like my mental state is causing my behavior, because my mental state represents the thing that's actually causing my behavior, and the representation is similar to what it's representing. That means that my mental states will consistently appear along with the real cause, which leads me to mistakenly believe my mental states play a causal role. So, Matthew's explanation here can help us understand how the causal illusion is generated, the illusion of consciousness causing our discussion of consciousness, or my comment about the taste of coffee. However, if it is just an illusion, then epiphenomenalism is vulnerable to an argument defended briefly in Lawrence Bonjour's article, Against Materialism. Namely, our discussion is not really about consciousness. This is a subtly different self-defeat argument, and I think it's much harder to refute. According to Bonjour, on epiphenomenalism, quote, it becomes difficult or seemingly impossible to see how verbal discussions of conscious phenomena can be genuinely about them in the way they seem obviously to be. How can people be talking about conscious states or saying anything significant about them if completely adequate causal explanations of their verbal behavior can be given that make no reference to such states? Even without invoking any specific version of the causal theory of reference, it's hard to see why verbal discussions that are entirely unaffected by what they purport to be about should be taken seriously. Thus, while a number of philosophers have in recent times been seemingly tempted by epiphenomenalism, it appears that they can have been genuinely advocating such a view about conscious states only if the view itself is false. End quote. So here's an argument. 1. If conscious phenomena have no effects on anything, this episode is not about consciousness. Premise 2. This episode is about consciousness. 3. Therefore, it is false that conscious phenomena have no effects on anything. It can be easy to miss that there are two distinct arguments here. The first is about verbal behavior, and the second is about intentionality. The epiphenomenalist has a decent response to the first, but not the second. The reply to the first argument goes, it seems like my mental state is causing my behavior because my mental state represents the thing that really is causing my behavior. So let's see how that works against the argument from intentionality. It seems like our discussion is about consciousness because my mental state represents the thing that really is causing our discussion. Well, then, the discussion is not really about consciousness. The first argument asks how I find myself using words like pain if pain doesn't cause verbal behavior. In other words, it points to an example of behavior that seems to have been caused by sensations and asks the epiphenomenalist to explain the behavior without mental causation. But the second argument goes further. The fact that I'm using the word pain and successfully referring to my experience is a problem for epiphenomenalism. So imagine an alien on a distant planet has a dream one night. He dreams of an odd, pinkish, bipedal primate who is qualitatively identical to me. But even if the alien starts talking about a person who looks and acts just like me, the alien couldn't really be talking about me. He's never met me. He's never interacted with anyone who's ever interacted with me. He has no connection to me whatsoever. If the alien is going to refer to me, he needs to have the appropriate connection to me, whatever that may be. So our verbal discussions of consciousness are obviously about consciousness. But on epiphenomenalism, the connection between consciousness and verbal behavior can't adequately account for this fact. If consciousness ceased to exist tomorrow, all our discourse about conscious phenomena would continue happily just as before. Just like if I didn't exist, the alien still would have had that dream.
That is why we could not be referring to consciousness in a world where the epiphenomenalist explanation of our verbal behavior is correct.
To quote Bonjour, how can we be talking about conscious phenomena or saying anything interesting about it if, as the epiphenomenalist insists, we have, or will have, a complete causal explanation of our verbal behavior that makes no reference to such states?
Of course, it is very hard to believe that our debates over consciousness would go on happily in its complete absence. That seems obviously false and presents a certain problem for epiphenomenalism. But the issue here is that the weak connection proposed by the epiphenomenalist cannot suffice for reference. It may be the case that the discourse over consciousness is the same in an epiphenomenalist and non-epiphenomenalist world, but similarity or identity between the sentences of a person in an epiphenomenalist world and the sentences of a person in a non-epiphenomenalist world does not imply sameness of reference. And just to reiterate that point, the discourse over consciousness may be the same in an epiphenomenalist world and a non-epiphenomenalist world, but similarity or identity between the sentences of a person in the former world and the sentences of a person in the latter world doesn't imply sameness of reference. Suppose epiphenomenalism were true. Could we say it was true? No, we couldn't. The falsity of epiphenomenalism is implied just by the enunciation of the theory. On epiphenomenalism, I can see how it might falsely appear that consciousness is causing verbal behavior, but it's harder to see how consciousness could genuinely be the referent of our discussion. How could we be talking about consciousness, successfully referring to consciousness, if conscious states don't have any causal influence over verbal behavior, directly or indirectly? The kind of connection proposed by the epiphenomenalist can hardly suffice for reference. That's why epiphenomenalism appears to be self-defeating. It's a view of consciousness that one can only defend if the view is false. Supports a causal connection. So why should we believe that there is a causal relationship between any phenomena? I mean, really think about it. I think pretty much any adequate answer to this question is going to imply that we should believe in mental causation. My evidence of a causal connection between all sorts of things follows the structure: when A happens, B happens. When A doesn't happen, B doesn't happen. There's a seemingly infinite list of causal connections supported by evidence exactly like this. What's the evidence that hunger is caused by lack of food? When I don't eat, I feel hungry. When I do eat, I don't feel hungry. One's experiences with hunger, along with the reported experiences of others, constitute more than enough evidence for the epiphenomenalist to accept a physical to mental causal connection here. Why should mental causation be held to a different standard? Some people think the mere correlation of A and B, no matter how consistent, is not enough to establish a causal connection. In the absence of an explanation of why B follows A, we are not rationally justified in affirming a causal connection between A and B. That is obviously wrong. You can very easily know that something is happening without having the slightest clue how it's happening. Our ancestors knew that children resemble their parents, but they didn't know about DNA. They could see that phenotypic traits were passed down from parent to offspring, even though they didn't know how it worked. Likewise, the interactionist, or any other non-epiphenomenalist, can safely affirm mental causation without the burden to immediately provide a detailed scientific account of how it works. You can know that something is happening without knowing how it's happening. The evidence that supports the causal influence of the mind is the exact same kind of evidence we appeal to in order to establish causal influence elsewhere. So I don't see how an epiphenomenalist can consistently reject the evidence for mental causation without undermining their own belief in physical causation. Remember, their skepticism of causation is limited to the mental. They are not causal reductionists when it comes to physical causation. If they were, what would be the relevant causal distinction between the mental and the material? If you're skeptical about causation across the board, you're not an epiphenomenalist. It seems inevitable that one's general views about causation will influence their views about mental causation and vice versa. Perhaps this is a trivial example of what he had in mind, but this is further evidence supporting the opening words of Thomas Nagel's Mind and Cosmos. Quote, "The aim of this book is to argue that the mind-body problem is not just a local problem, having to do with the relation between mind, brain, and behavior in living animal organisms, but that it invades our understanding of the entire cosmos and its history." So let's return to how the epiphenomenalist explains the vivid but misleading appearance of mental causation. Supposedly, it seems like my mental state is causing my behavior because my mental state represents the thing that is causing my behavior. The felt sensation is a shadow of what really causes our behavior. That is, what makes us wince is not the pain, but the neurophysiological process which causes the pain. That means that my mental states will consistently appear along with the real cause, which leads me to mistakenly believe that my mental states play a causal role. So, that's an interesting possibility, but why think this is the way things actually are? Granting that this is a coherent possibility doesn't imply anything about its plausibility. This wouldn't be the first proposal in philosophy that offers a vision of reality that is radically at odds with common sense, but is nonetheless possible. If I assert that the world was created last Thursday, you could point to these seemingly infinite lines of evidence supporting an Earth with a history that goes back farther than a week. All of the evidence is against last Thursdayism. But wait, the skeptic has a coherent explanation of how that evidence came to be. So would they then be correct in saying that there is no evidence against last Thursdayism? No, obviously not. Evidence against a hypothesis is not defanged in virtue of a coherent response. So it may be the case that, as Sven Walter puts it, there is no phenomenological difference between a situation in which epiphenomenalism is false and a situation in which epiphenomenalism is true. But so it is with last Thursdayism. Presumably, one's rejection of last Thursdayism is warranted. So whatever your understanding of evidence may be, that fact needs to be accommodated. So given that the evidence that supports the causal influence of the mind is the same kind of evidence that supports the causal influence of the physical, here's a potential dilemma for epiphenomenalism. If the epiphenomenalist can successfully remove the justification for accepting the apparent evidence of mental causation, they may have removed the justification for accepting the evidence of physical causation in the process. But physical causation is a component of epiphenomenalism. So either the epiphenomenalist will fail in removing justification for mental causation, and thus fail to support their position, or they'll succeed and inadvertently remove justification for accepting physical causation. As noted earlier, epiphenomenalism draws a hard line between the mental and the physical when it comes to causal powers specifically. The epiphenomenalist makes a causal distinction between the physical and the mental. What would this distinction consist in if they didn't accept causation in the physical realm? So, either way, epiphenomenalism cannot be justified. But who knows, maybe the epiphenomenalist can meet that challenge, maybe they can remove justification for accepting mental causation without inadvertently removing justification for accepting physical causation. If you don't believe in mental causation, I'm not sure what evidence you've seen of physical causation that's somehow more convincing than the evidence of mental causation. If you could only pick one, you'd think it would be mental causation. So that brings us to the third section, the plausibility of the phenomenal powers view. Hedda Hassel-Merck has defended the view that some phenomenal properties produce and thereby metaphysically necessitate their effects, quote, in virtue of how they feel, or in virtue of their intrinsic phenomenal character alone. She defends an evolutionary argument for phenomenal powers inspired by William James, one which we'll return to in the next section on psychophysical harmony. The epiphenomenalist denies not only that the mind can exert control over the body, but also that mental states cause other mental states. So to the extent that we're justified in maintaining that there are metaphysically necessary causal connections between certain mental states, we're justified in rejecting epiphenomenalism. Quote, the phenomenal powers view is the view that phenomenal properties, in other words, properties which characterize what it is like to be in conscious states, have non-Humean causal powers, which is to say that they metaphysically necessitate their effects, in virtue of how they feel, in other words, in virtue of their phenomenal character, as opposed to in virtue of entering into contingent regularities, as per Humean or Lewisian regularity theory, or being constrained by external governing laws, as per Armstrongian realism about laws. For example, pain has the power to make subjects who experience it try to avoid it in the absence of interference from other motives, such as a belief that enduring the pain would avoid a greater pain or promote a greater pleasure in the future, in virtue of feeling bad, in other words, in virtue of its distinctively disagreeable, repulsive, phenomenal character. Also, this necessitation is intelligible, not brute. When we know how pain feels, we understand why pain has this effect, and not some other one. End quote.
While I'm not a causal reductionist, it seems much easier to be skeptical of causation in the physical world than the mental world. I'm directly acquainted with my mental states, and therefore much more intimately aware of certain properties they possess. For example, the feeling of unbearable pain is consistently followed by another kind of mental state, the feeling of wanting less, wanting it to stop, trying to avoid it, etc. And sure, we can imagine shuffling the deck. We can think of some disharmonious possible world where wanting more followed the state of unbearable pain instead. But I don't think we can conceive of that disharmonious succession occurring in virtue of the phenomenal character of pain. In other words, certain phenomenal properties produce their effects in virtue of how they feel, and it's not ideally conceivable that unbearable pain could have the effect of pleasure in virtue of how it feels. It appears as if certain phenomenal properties produce their effects. They have non-human causal powers. That is, they metaphysically necessitate their effects. Again, while I'm not a reductionist about physical causation, it is much easier to get in the Humean mindset when it comes to billiard ball collisions or neurological events, as opposed to mental causation. And David Hume himself seems to have recognized this asymmetry. Quote, "It may be pretended that the resistance which we meet with in bodies, obliging us frequently to exert our force and call upon all our power, this gives us the idea of force and power. It is this nisus or strong endeavor of which we are conscious that is the original impression from which this idea is copied. But we attribute power to a vast number of objects, where we never can suppose this resistance or exertion of force to take place, to inanimate matter, which is not capable of this sentiment. It must, however, be confessed that the animal nisus which we experience, though it can afford no accurate, precise idea of power, enters very much into that vulgar, inaccurate idea which is formed of it." On epiphenomenalism, mental states don't cause anything, not even other mental states, but it seems exceedingly plausible that certain phenomenal properties metaphysically necessitate or produce their phenomenal effects. If that is the case, then epiphenomenalism is necessarily false. Moving along to psychophysical harmony. Epiphenomenalism is uncontroversially the most vulnerable to the problem of psychophysical harmony. As Dustin Crummett and Brian Cutter explain, quote, "Psychophysical harmony consists in the fact that phenomenal states are correlated with physical states and with one another in strikingly fortunate ways. For example, phenomenal states are correlated with behavior and functioning that is justified or rationalized by those very phenomenal states. For example, pain is correlated with avoidance behavior. And phenomenal states are correlated with verbal reports and judgments that are made true by those very phenomenal states. For example, we say, I'm in such and such phenomenal state, and sure enough, we are." End quote. Not everyone immediately sees what's supposed to be puzzling about psychophysical harmony. But as Orwell once put it, to see what's in front of one's nose needs a constant struggle. For those interested, I spoke with Dustin Crummett about psychophysical harmony, as well as Brian Cutter, and hosted a debate between Crummett and Philip Goff. I also spoke a bit more about it in the video Debunking Myself on God and the Hypothesis of Indifference. There's also a thoroughly critical examination of the argument from psychophysical harmony for theism posted on the blog of Naturalism Next. So Crummett and Cutter go on to argue that this is not just a problem for epiphenomenalism, it's everyone's problem. Well, it's almost everyone's problem. While I'm pretty sure that this is everyone's problem, I'm comparatively far more certain that it's epiphenomenalism's problem. At the very least, it's easiest to see how it's a problem for epiphenomenalism, which is why Crummett and Cutter typically introduce their argument by assuming the truth of epiphenomenal property dualism. Epiphenomenalism, in other words, seems uniquely vulnerable among metaphysical theories of consciousness. Now, some of you might take this even farther than I do. It's not just easiest to see how it's a problem for epiphenomenalism. It's not just that epiphenomenalism is uniquely vulnerable. It is literally just epiphenomenalism's problem.
If we accept mental causation, the problem goes away. Why wouldn't the rejection of epiphenomenalism be sufficient to solve the problem, like if we became interactionists? In short, a causal connection doesn't guarantee a harmonious causal connection. Postulating a causal relationship between A and B doesn't mean that B will be rationalized or justified by A. Say that we grant that my willing to raise my right arm has causal efficacy over my arm. Why would that guarantee that my right arm would be raised? Maybe some other behavior would be brought about by my act of will. Granting a causal connection between the mind and the body doesn't ensure that the connection will be a rationally appropriate connection. Quote, interactionist dualists reject causal completeness, claiming that phenomenal states have a non-redundant influence on physical processing in the brain. But interactionism by itself doesn't explain psychophysical harmony or render it unsurprising. Consider a text machine whose output semantically corresponds with its sound output. One might hypothesize that the sound outputs exert some causal influence on text outputs, but this hypothesis by itself would not lead us to expect a semantic correspondence between text and sound. After all, there are countless ways in which text output might causally depend on sound, most of which do not push the text in the direction of semantic correspondence. Higher pitched sounds might have biased the machine towards outputting text near the end of the alphabet. Louder sounds might have biased the machine towards longer text outputs. The timing of the text outputs might have tracked the rhythm of the sounds. These dependence patterns would have made the text-sound relationship somewhat different from what it would have been in the absence of sound-to-text influence, but in general, not any closer to semantic correspondence. In conversation, many philosophers have emphatically rejected the idea that mental causation is insufficient to solve the problem. I tend to side with Dustin and Brian, but I can't help but wonder if I've missed something. Psychophysical harmony remains a problem for epiphenomenalism regardless, one that's been apparent since at least William James. Epiphenomenalism is obviously very counterintuitive. But does that really matter? Yes. Yes, it does. I've defended the epistemic value of intuition before and discussed it previously with Michael Humer, but I saved this section for last since many people insist on being wrong about the epistemic value of intuition. What is an intuition? Roughly, an intuition is an intellectual seeming. A seeming, or appearance, is just an experience in which something seems to be the case. Among intellectual seemings, there are inferential and non-inferential varieties. The former we call inferences, the latter we call intuitions. People will often use intuition as synonymous with intellectual seeming, and that's honestly fine with me, but our taxonomy should still at least have the capacity to distinguish between inferential and non-inferential intellectual seemings. According to Michael Humer, an intuition is, quote, a mental state in which something seems correct upon direct intellectual reflection, as opposed to observation or reasoning, end quote. So, a non-inferential intellectual appearance. Let's break that down a bit. To quote Humer again, there's a type of experience known as an appearance or seeming, which is what you report when you say, it seems to me that this proposition is true. This is a mental state that represents something as being the case. It has propositional content, as philosophers say. It is distinct from a belief, but it normally causes beliefs. Under normal circumstances, you believe what seems true to you, because it seems true. And just to back up a step, there are several kinds of seemings and appearances, including sensory experiences, memory experiences, and introspective awareness, among others. Quote, intellectual appearances are appearances that result from exercising the faculty of reason. In other words, thinking about things, as opposed to looking with your eyes, hearing with your ears, etc. Among intellectual appearances, there are two species, inferential appearances and intuitions. Inferential appearances are experiences in which some proposition seems true to you in the light of some other propositions that you already believe or that already seem true to you that seemingly support that proposition. Intuitions are intellectual appearances that are not inferential. That is, they are experiences in which some proposition seems true to you on its own, rather than in the light of something else. End quote. So good examples of intuition include truths that we label as self-evident. When I reflect on some fundamental axiom or basic logical truth, it seems obviously right to me. You know, A equals A, the Kolmogorov axioms, that kind of thing. It might be harder to attend to that experience than a perceptual experience, for example, of the green grass in front of me, but I think it's nevertheless an experience I'm having. It's an intellectual appearance, rather than a sensory appearance, but they're both experiences, and in that way, intuition seems like a pretty direct justification for our beliefs. None of this is to suggest that intuition can't be wrong. Part of the appeal of Humer's appearance-based account of intuition is that it easily accommodates the fact that our intuition can be wrong. Appearances can be misleading, and we don't always believe what initially seems to be the case. In other words, seemings don't necessarily cause beliefs. They are distinct. If one were to actually reject intuition wholesale, the justification for a number of very obvious things we believe would vanish, and presumably everything based on them as well. The divide is not between people who rely on intuition and people who don't. The divide is between those who realize they rely on intuition and those who do not realize they rely on intuition. So the fact that epiphenomenalism is counterintuitive should be fairly obvious. In his article, Mind Control, philosopher Peter Sherstedt Hughes gives several plausible examples of mental causation. Quote, will to survive to defensive actions, hunger to finding food, thirst to provisioning drink, lust to finding a mate, ambition to attaining qualification, compassion to helping others, picturing potential moves in chess, composing music, designing architecture, planning the day, logic for technology, mathematics for physics, endeavoring to learn an activity, meditating to consolidate one's mind, focusing on sentences in Hegel to comprehend them. He asks, are all these proposed examples of mental causation merely delusional intuitions, forms of consciousness that are completely impotent, useless? Earlier, I mentioned Sven Walter's claim that there is no phenomenological difference between a situation in which epiphenomenalism is false and a situation in which epiphenomenalism is true. His point seems to be that our experience of mental causation counts as no evidence against epiphenomenalism, since there's no phenomenological difference between the epiphenomenalist and non-epiphenomenalist worlds. I disagree with the first part, as I explained previously, but I'm also doubtful of the second part. Is it really the case that there's no predicted phenomenological difference? It's not just that epiphenomenalism is initially counterintuitive. It remains counterintuitive upon reflection, at least in my case. If all the listed examples of mental causation are illusions, they are extremely stubborn ones. In the case of some illusions, knowledge of the illusion, how the trick is pulled, helps lift the veil. In fact, in some cases, you can't unsee the reality of the situation, and it can be hard to grasp how you were ever under the spell to begin with. But when we reflect on these examples of mental causation, the illusion just doesn't go away. The situation seems more analogous to an ordinary perception rather than an illusion. Upon seeing a tree outside my window, you can insist that it's just an illusion, and I can even believe that it's an illusion, but my perception will remain more or less unaltered, even if my overall phenomenology has changed, given my distrust of the perceptual seeming. The reason my perception of the tree remains unaltered is that I am not under an illusion. So if my experience of mental causation is illusory, why does the illusion persist even after peeking behind the curtain? This is not intended as a knockdown argument against epiphenomenalism. I'm disputing the claim that there's no expected phenomenological difference on epiphenomenalism versus non-epiphenomenalism. On the hypothesis that all of Sherstedt Hughes' examples are mere illusions, we might expect to see through the illusion, as we do with many others. Yet the illusion persists, as does my perception of the tree outside the window. In sum, epiphenomenalism is highly counterintuitive, in other words, absurd, that our feelings, thoughts, experiences, sensations, and so on make a difference to our behavior and to other mental states seems as obvious as anything. As William Robinson notes, this argument is surely the briefest of those against epiphenomenalism, but it may have been more persuasive than any other. Thank you.
So why reject epiphenomenalism? 1. Epiphenomenalism is self-defeating. 2. The evidence that supports the causal influence of mental states is the exact same kind of evidence for causal influence in other areas, which not only supports mental causation, but also raises the threat of undermining the epiphenomenalist's claim that the physical has causal powers. 3. The phenomenal powers view is plausible and entails the falsity of epiphenomenalism. In short, there are plausible examples of causal necessity in the mind. 4. Among metaphysical theories of consciousness, epiphenomenalism is the most vulnerable to the problem of psychophysical harmony. I may be convinced that it's everyone's problem, but I'm relatively far more certain that it's epiphenomenalism's problem. And finally, epiphenomenalism is extremely counterintuitive. As Paul Draper put it, wild ideas are needed to explain consciousness, but I don't think epiphenomenalism is the right wild idea. Thank you for listening. I've been Emerson Green, and I'll see you next time.